So right now, let's bring in David. It's time for the Media Beat. David, of course, joins us every Friday at this time. We rebroadcast David over the course of the weekend and also following our 12 new news next week as well. David has his own website, themediabeat.us. He's also a PBS television correspondent reporting on ethics and belief. And once again, we say good morning to David Terechuk. Good morning, David. Thanks for joining us today.
Good morning. Good to be with you again and reporting into the always-on-point Marshall Miles, not from New York City, the media capital of the world, but once again from Maine, the great state of Maine.
You know, it must have been very interesting for you to see, sitting there in Maine, what happened in New York City and the rest of the East Coast from the remnants of a hurricane.
Sure, the remnants of Ida coming northeast, it did terrible damage, as we know. It's extraordinary to see that even when we'd had the prologue of Ida making landfall in where it was first expected in the Gulf with Louisiana and Mississippi, causing something like 13 deaths there with very high winds. But when it came further north, came to the northeastern region, and there in New York, New Jersey, and Pennsylvania, about 50 deaths. Not such high winds, but lots and lots of water. And evidently, although expected and forecast and warnings given out about its ferocity, its likely ferocity, still, it seems that many of our northeastern neighbors were taken by surprise by it.
You know,
and, inevitably, there's a lot of questioning about preparedness and readiness for these things coming in the future, because as the new governor, Kathy Hochul of New York, has been saying, this is the new reality. This is climate change working its way out in practice. And it's not a good sight. It's a horrific sight, in fact.
And the problem with people is just a week before, there was a warning put out by the National Weather Service for another hurricane and a tropical depression that might form into that. And it didn't. And people criticize the Weather Service, but what people have to understand is, well, the National Weather Service issues, and they did almost a week before, flash flood watches for the entire area. It's saying that there could be anywhere from 3 to 5 to up 8 inches of rain. They criticize when the National Weather Service, when something goes wrong and it doesn't happen, and then they act surprised and they're not warned when something does happen. Well, I have to say right now, all the weather services did an amazing job in trying to prepare people for this, and it just didn't work.
Well, yes, it's a case often, as often I'm afraid in the prediction business, of being damned if you do and damned if you don't. It's largely a feature of human psychology, I think. I mean, we gear ourselves up for something terrible, and if it's not terrible, we feel in a strange way disappointed, and we want to blame someone. And of course, it's that readiness to blame is all the more serious when we're warned of something, but not we don't actually take it seriously enough, and then when it turns out to be extremely serious, we're prone to blame the messengers again. What's actually needed is a sensible response to clear warnings, and we got clear warnings in this case. And I suppose what many of the authorities are saying in both the city of New York and the state is that while the warnings were there, they were cased in terms of how much rainfall there was likely to be in a day. What wasn't really expected is the concentration of the sheer volume of this extraordinary volume of water that was dropping from the sky. Again, to quote Governor Kathy Hochul, she says that what's threatening the region now is not so much massive amounts of water from the ocean or from Long Island Sound, but it's falling from the sky. And certainly in the case of New York City, the infrastructure, particularly that underground, and in the lower levels of buildings, is just not prepared for a massive influx, a massive inundation of water. 2 inches of water in an hour, for instance, is something that I just know from my own personal experience, is that the New York subway system is just not capable of handling. It's a horrible way to see it, but in effect, the city of New York is when its own sewer system gets overloaded, the New York subway system becomes, in a sense, a reserve sewer system. And that makes for an awful lot of clogging and an awful lot of danger and a horrible mess to clear up afterwards. It's only just starting to get back to normal today.
I'll just put it this way: my cellar had to be pumped out of a foot of water, so that's way out.
Well,
here.
from even closer personal experience.
And you know, we only received 5 inches of rain. Never mind the city, which received a little over 8 inches of rain, but 5 inches of that rain came down in 2.5 hours.
Exactly,
which was just unbelievable. Well, with that news, should we play the fanfare here for some good reporting?
Sure. We need to concentrate on other parts of the world and other parts of the news scene.
All right.
Afghanistan continues to be the scene of horrific change, of course, with the Taliban taking over and that chaotic exodus from the country by American troops and many American citizens and Afghan citizens who supported America during its 20 years of presence in their country. But I want to concentrate on one particular piece of journalism that came out through that the course of all that, just published in the last few days. My fanfare is for an Afghan-born correspondent, Mujib Mashal, who was a boy during the previous Taliban. He works now for the New York Times and was back in Kabul again on the day that the current Taliban took over the capital, Kabul. They'd been making enormous advances through the country as a whole, and he wanted to be back in Kabul for whatever was going to happen. I don't think anyone, and including him, expected the takeover of the nation's capital to happen as quickly. But he adapted well. His normal base is in India, in New Delhi, the capital. But back in Kabul, he was seeing colleagues and his family, his own family, and he took the opportunity to deliver for the rest of us a poignant essay as an insider, as the city stood on that day, poised between its troubled present and its very, very unknown future. He's got that capacity for observant reporting that makes for very insightful scene setting, and I recommend the piece enormously because it noticing things that's a reporter's job after all. He gathers all the details that make for a very full portrait. He gathered the nuances of a situation as only an insider can. He was capturing, for instance, an argument on a bus that he was riding on. An argument, yeah, because as we know, no nation is ever a monolith when it comes to public opinion in that nation. And the argument here that he reported for us on, taking place on the bus between passengers, getting very agitated, disagreeing with each other about what the Taliban and the United States have and haven't done for the country of Afghanistan, which we have to remember has been at war for 40 years. A very striking piece of journalism that stands out amongst the welter of very, very good coverage as a whole coming out of Afghanistan over these troubled weeks. He's a reporter for us to keep an eye on, I think.
All right, some of the good news and reporting news.
I need to say something else about the Afghanistan reporting at the moment, too. As we know, there's great anxiety about how a Taliban regime is going to treat women once again. We know all too well what a terrible record they had for abusing women or keeping them in terrible constraint when they were in power once before. I just wanted to remind people that amongst the international reporters who are there, there's some very significant presences, which are female presences. Susanna George of Washington Post and Lise Doucette of the BBC are in Kabul. They've gone in. I mean, and this is a piece of journalistic bravery I think we need to notice and remark upon. And more generally speaking, the Afghans themselves in the journalistic field, we mustn't forget that we're going to use a kind of past tense here now, there have been 700 female journalists working in Kabul, and now, after the Taliban takeover, it's estimated by Reporters Without Borders, the organization to support journalism worldwide, it calculates that there are now fewer than 100 who are working since the Taliban militants took over. So it's important to recognize that that's one indication of how the Taliban rule is turning out. And we also mustn't forget that America's own official journalists, if you like, this U.S. State Department supported Radio Liberty and Voice of America, have had a presence in Afghanistan for a long time, established very quickly after the American invasion in 2001. And despite all the effort at evacuation of both American citizens and Afghan supporters of the American presence, there are still 500 of those journalists left, well, not all journalists, but media workers of all kinds who work in American-supported radio. They're still left behind in Afghanistan, too. Let's not forget them.
No, the exit is never clean, it's never swift, it's never complete, it takes a while. If you look back at any war, it doesn't matter whether it was World War I, World War II, the Vietnam War, Russia's exit, these things are just almost as terrifying, the results, as the war itself. I want to get away from that and come back to the United States, and we really got a very big indication of something that I think is very, very strong, and that is Chief Justice John Roberts really no longer has the court in a firm grasp like most chief justices do.
It's interesting. The controversial Texas abortion law was very pointedly not blocked by the Supreme Court. They took a vote of 5-4 on that, allowing the Texas state legislature's abortion law, which in essence bans abortion effectively for the entire state. Any woman whose pregnancy has advanced more than, up to 6 weeks, which is an appallingly short measure of time by which to implement this ban on abortion. But that's the new reality for Texas. And that vote of 5-4 is very significant because there were four dissenters. Each single one of those dissenters, of a liberal bent, of course, or three of them anyway, wrote their very forthright dissents. And among added to the three liberal dissenters was the Chief Justice himself. Yes, the Chief Justice dissenting from a majority opinion of the court as a whole. Which, of course, as we know, because of the Trump appointees, has tilted very much to the right, and quite appropriately, legal commentators on screen and in print have been saying that they see, and it is very obvious why they see, very perilous time ahead for women's right to choose. And as we know, 16 other states have passed laws to ban or drastically limit abortions. They're lying dormant on the books now, waiting for the Supreme Court to make a new ruling that will probably, or at least the signs are, will fall into line with this current non-judgment, if you like, this decision not to intervene in Texas. When the next opportunity to reconsider the legal precedent Roe versus Wade that has set for 50 years now women's right to abortion and the right to privacy over that abortion, there's still a chance for Texas law, of course, to be brought to the Supreme Court again. But I think all eyes are looking for the moment on the date that's coming up in September. Sometime in the fall, anyway, I'm not sure of the exact date, but coming soon, the Supreme Court will be considering a similar piece of legislation to the Texas one in Mississippi, in which the limit there is 15 weeks. One legal commentator was saying this is an interesting example of Texas providing us with legislation that makes Mississippi look reasonable.
I look at the Texas law, and what really amazes me is that it's not enforceable by the state. It is now any individual can bring a lawsuit against somebody who aids in abortion past that timeline.
Aids and abets,
yep,
is the legal phrase being used. Yes, it's an extraordinary piece of, at first blush, it may look like an abandonment of responsibility, but in fact it's a very clever piece of Texan canniness. What they're doing there is dissipating the state's interference in the privacy of an ordinary citizen's life, and they've even set up a tip website, a kind of whistle. The phrases used to describe it will change depending upon your position on the issue, of course. The authorities are calling it a whistleblower site. You can go online and register in it any information you have about someone who is, anyone who is aiding and abetting an abortion, even down, it's been suggested, to the Uber driver who might drive a patient to an abortion operation. And the other words applied to it, include a kind of deputizing of members of the public to enact this ban on abortions. Other terms for it, of course, are vigilantism being applied to this. It has a horrific flavor to it. And yet here it is, enacted by the Texas legislature, renowned throughout the world, of course, for its progressiveness. I say that with heavy sarcasm. As I say, it has a distinctly ominous flavor to the whole thing.
I want to move away from the United States for a while. A couple of stories from the EU and Great Britain. They both now have decided they will not recognize the Taliban government. And also, a pretty amazing shakeup very quickly in Japan's government, as the Japan Prime Minister is going to step down.
Yeah, after only a year. I mean, following previous Prime Minister Abe, he was a tough act to follow anyway, but it's been a very bad year for the Japan government, and their opinion poll figures are slumping into unbelievable, well, not unbelievable, it's very, very credible, low levels of favorability rating. It's been a bad year because, of course, continuing economic trouble, of course. Japan now only the third biggest economy in the world, because China has already overtaken them, and so that's a troublesome backdrop for it all. But COVID management has been appalling, and in the midst of it, of course, although there was delay involved, Nonetheless, in the end, the Olympics and the Paralympics were held anyway, and this must have been the single most individual decried, almost universally decried amongst the public as a governmental decision. The most unpopular, probably the most unpopular Olympics ever staged in terms of the public's feeling in the host country. And now the Prime Minister is sensibly not resigning, but making it clear to his own party that he will not be in the slate for the upcoming elections. So Japan will have to go back to the pattern that had become very familiar until Abe took over, of a very rapid turnover of prime ministers. And we can expect some new faces and perhaps a greater consideration of and attention being paid to public opinion in Japan. It's been certainly made very clear to the government by the public that they are not in favor and they do need to make changes.
All right, and I will go out to the great state of California, where now the latest of independent polls show that roughly 58% of the people who were polled were going to vote no against removing him, they were only at 39%. So
Governor Newsom is beginning to breathe a little more easily about his chances of not being recalled, although the recall election is scheduled, I think, for the 15th.
Yeah.
It looks like he may be able to squeak through, or perhaps it's more than squeaking. The part of the problem, I think, is that there's not a very clear momentum for any one of the very many alternatives who are offering themselves as a replacement for Governor Newsom. Mr. Elder, the Republican choice, is dawdling somewhat in the public opinion polls. That seems to be the picture that's building up in Sacramento right now.
All right, and I guess finally, just because this is bubbling around in New York, two Trump Organization executives have appeared before a grand jury looking into the president's company. Not the president himself, but the Trump Organization itself.
Yeah, let's make a rare mention. We don't often go back to the affairs of the previous guy, as President Biden calls him. Actually, this is more about his company, the Trump Organization, and that curious cabal of people who make up its executives, along, of course, with Trump family members. And the Wall Street Journal is reporting on something that is going on out of the public view on this issue. Prosecutors in New York have been fighting with the Trump Organization, as I say, out of public sight, over documents that the DA's office has subpoenaed. As you know, Manhattan DA Cyrus Vance Jr., I should point out, he's the son of a former Secretary of State in the Carter era. But the attorney's office has been fighting over documents This is all background to what's been happening in that investigation, which the attorney general, the district attorney, has been pursuing. There have been two court appearances concerning that dispute, and they took place last week, but they were sealed court appearances. In the famous phrase of journalists who have to deal with this kind of leak material that they get. This is, in the Wall Street Journal's phrase, this is according to people familiar with the matter. But happening, as you say, in public, we've got the grand jury being treated to two people being subpoenaed to appear before that jury. One is Jeffrey McConney, a senior finance official, who's appearing for the second time, by the way, And for the first time, Matthew Calamari Jr., we have another father and son combination here. Matthew Calamari Jr. is the head of security for the Trump Organization. What a job, huh? And he's also the son of the older Matthew Calamari, who's been chief operating officer for the company. But he started out, you might remember, as Donald Trump's bodyguard. And it's all part of an investigation that's alleged into what's alleged to be a 15-year-long tax fraud scheme. It involves off-the-book payments and perks for company employees. So that's certainly one to watch.
It's interesting to name Calamari for the head of security. You couldn't.
Well, we must not make the obvious joke. No, I don't think.
But you can't write. You can't make this stuff up. You really can't.
That's true. And of course, we must remember that who's already indicted. I mean, don't forget the indictments already on the books here.
Amazing.
The chief financial officer, Alan Weisselberg, and the company itself have been indicted since July on tax dodging charges. That's the legal framework here.
All right, David, always great to speak to you. We'll speak to you next week back in New York City.
Absolutely.
All right, take care.